The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on September 7, 2019. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I had a totally different talk in mind up until a few days ago when somebody here at Dharma Field asked me some questions about this book here. It's the Chan Master Hui Hai, The Zen Teaching of Instantaneous Awakening. This is by John Blofeld. So this is Steve talked from Blofeld's translation of Huang Po yesterday. And after Huang Po, he then produced this book, which isn't quite as well known as the Huang Po book. But there's some interesting things he has to say in here, Master Hui Hai. And here's the Zen Teachings of Instantaneous Awakening, or Sudden Awakening. Sudden Illumination is all Blofeld has it here. I'm sure perhaps many of you are familiar with the term silent illumination. Well, this is sudden illumination, which is also probably pretty silent, maybe. Anyway, but we'll take a look. So he talks about that a little bit. And the question the person put to me was how he talks about the mirror, the image of a mirror, and how that works, and objects appearing before the mirror, and things of that sort. So it prompted me to go back to this book and look. I've lectured from this at Sishen a couple of times before. And he had a number of specific questions that he wanted me to look at. And some of those I'll get to today. But there was one that kind of stood out. I'm going to begin right at the front of the book here, where Hui Hai begins to talk, but move kind of quickly through weaving through some of these themes that he has, which we'll be looking at here in a little bit. But I thought before I do that, I want to jump to page 93 here, where we're well into it now. But it's just something that I would like to cover today, and I doubt in the next hour I'm going to get this far. So I thought I'd like to say something about this now, because it also relates very much to many things that he's pointing out in this book. So here, Hui Hai has been talking a bit about this sudden illumination, but he's talking about pacifying the mind. This silent or sudden illumination is with pacifying the mind, quieting the mind. And here he says something rather interesting that I really would like to bring out today, because I think it's pretty important. And so in case I don't arrive at it by other means, I'll just jump right into it now and then kind of back up to where he starts, and we can maybe approach this probably without getting this far, though. Okay, well, anyway, so here he's saying something about this question, and he's got the questioner asking him throughout the book here of various things. And here he's, the questioner had been earlier, he says a few things before he gets to this point, asking about the absolute. He wants to know if it's not really empty. The term he uses here is void, as Blofeld has it translated, the same in the Huang Po book. But anyway, so in answering this, Hui Hai says that, and again, the point that he makes, this sudden illumination is this matter of pacifying the mind. This comes with pacifying the mind. So he's been talking about here, and then he says that if instead of pacifying our minds, as we do in meditation, settling the mind. You know, I often point out to you, I tell you to watch your mind. Pay attention to what we could call your mind. Just pay attention to what's taking place here. And in this way, if you really start to observe this, this will pacify, quiet the mind, settle the mind. Over time, because you start to realize how you're stirring it up all the time. Just stirring it up, stirring it up, stirring it up. And nothing to do with reality. But we stir it up. Though we think this is reality. The reality is I get stirred up. And we get caught by that. And this is what Huihai says about this. He says, if instead of pacifying our minds, he says, this is interesting. This is why I want to bring it. And rely on the scriptures to achieve enlightenment. He says, we are undertaking the impossible. So if instead of quieting the mind, pacifying the mind, settling the mind, we undertake to study the scriptures, he says. How does he put it? We rely on the scriptures to achieve enlightenment. As if this way were academic study. And we think that somehow we can work our way through studying the scriptures, doing the readings, all of this, and arrive at enlightenment that way. Because what do you expect? There's going to be some description here? Another idea, a concept that you grab hold of? And this will be enlightenment? This isn't it at all. This enlightenment, this sudden illumination that he speaks of here, is settling the mind. But really, settling the mind. Not just simply quieting it down, pacifying the mind by maybe just entertaining happy thoughts or soothing thoughts or quieting thoughts. Something like that. It is in by watching the mind, by observing the mind and seeing how agitated it is, even in the most quiet moment, yet there's still stirrings going on there. Without seeing all of this as empty, or he compares it here to the void, might be some problems with that. But without that, without seeing this for what it is, these little stirrings will still be real to you, and you will hold on to them. And as Dogen says, that he says, if you don't, he says this directly to his monks, the reason you don't wake up, he says, is because you don't relinquish your views. You don't relinquish the little things that might be coming and going in the mind. You continue to take them as though they are real, substantial. They pertain to reality in some way. What Huihai, one of his main objectives, it seems, in his teaching is to really point this out, that this isn't the case at all. But as long as we continue to hold with these various things, then we just continue to stir up the mind. And that's why he makes his unusual statement here, because he's talking about karmic activity, karma, you know, that's, of course, then we think about good karma and bad karma. Maybe Buddhas produce good karma. That's all wrong. That's activity. And karmic activity, he says here, just before he made this statement, he says, with karma, what he's pointing is activity is involved with this. That's what it is, really, karma. And it doesn't matter whether it's so-called good karma or bad karma. The good and bad would be very questionable, which you would see if the mind becomes pacified, becomes quiet. It doesn't become pacified in a sleep. Far from it. It becomes quite awake and alert. I think there's a point here where he makes it. It's not on this page, but we might hit that. But it's far from a pacified mind, a settled mind is far from being weak or quiet or asleep or something like that. It is this very reality without being pulled out from this totality, the settled mind. So we have Sushin. Not to do this so we get enlightenment and that sort of. It is this very settling of the mind. Steve was talking about yesterday, the collecting of them. That's literally what it means, translated into English. Settling the mind, collecting the mind, and collecting the mind and bringing it here, watching it, being aware of it, not doing anything about it. Remember Yaku-san, another teacher in our lineage, just sitting. His teacher, Sekito, also in our lineage, of course, his teacher. Sekito comes along and says, well, you know, what are you doing? You've heard me say this many times, and most of you, I think. What are you doing? And Yaku-san says, I'm not doing anything. He's not doing anything. No activity. Even no activity of mind, or of his mind. Mind is otherwise synonymous with activity as such, but that's totality, and that's radically different from the part or some individuated thing, maybe you or something else, that's engaged in activity, or such as your mind. If your mind is engaged in activity, as he's saying here, all these karmic forces are at play here, he says. And this comes with even something like reading the scriptures, studying the scriptures. If instead of pacifying our minds, we rely on the scriptures to achieve enlightenment. Now this is relying on the scriptures. It doesn't mean you shouldn't consult them or read them, get familiar with what is said in these various texts and teachings that we have. But if we're not watching our minds, we will grip them. We will get ideas. We'll form ideas about this. And then we're thinking, well, then we should do this. And we're moving around and we're trying to arrange things instead of just seeing the immediacy of this moment. Just seeing what needs to be done. Just seeing what is being pointed out. Rather than assuming that what is being pointed out is something particular and something particular that I must, I don't know, do something about or connect with or relate to or something. What? It doesn't matter. It's just seeing, sitting like Yaku-san, observing what is taking place now. The most dominant thing there, if there's anything taking place, would be, well, my mind. You know, that's what we assume, but we might not be thinking about that because we're looking at something out there that we take as being real and objective and separate and apart from me. I'm relating to it in some way. I see it, I hear it, I taste it, I think it, or whatever it might be. So there's this thing going on, and we think that that's what I've just said right there, that pointing out in that way, that this is ultimately what's real. And somehow through doing this, we're going to, I don't know, or what, arrange it in the right way, or get hold of it in the right way, that suddenly we'll experience enlightenment. That's just simply not what's at work here. So elsewhere here, he says it right here, going on from that. I'll just reread that again. He says, if instead of pacifying our minds, we rely on scriptures to achieve enlightenment, we are undertaking the impossible. You will not find anything, not even in the scriptures, the Buddhist teachings. This is why, too, I've said this, I pointed out, like, Dharma teaching is kind of like if you were to write it out, say, up on a chalkboard. If I were a right-handed person, I guess I'd somehow be doing it like this, and we're coming along with the left hand here, erasing what we're putting up. That's the nature of Dharma teaching. Not meant for you to take hold of it, because this is why Suzuki, I've pointed out many times, when my talk is over, your listening's over. No need to remember. This is the nature of Dharma teaching. Teaching where we think we're actually arranging things and, you know, putting it in the right way so you understand we're structuring something there. Yeah, these things you want to hang on to. And there's plenty of that in our everyday life that we need to take care of. There's nothing wrong or bad about that. But when it comes to this matter of waking up to reality and the nature of reality, he'll tell you in here just what this, well, not what it means, but, well, it just kind of really points to just what that is. In effect, you really won't have any real problems after that, even though, of course, there's always the 83 problems. But this will be to resolve that 84th problem. But this comes with actually just seeing what is here. It's not in getting the right idea, and not even from the scriptures. So the Dharma teaching is, you know, it's something that you can erase as soon as you put it up. And the Buddha, like in, you know, his teaching is like a finger pointing at the moon. You know, it's just something pointing the moon, say being reality, truth, enlightenment. And usually we can just, the teachings can just direct our attention, or maybe we might notice it, and then we can just see. So that's how the teachings work. There's nothing in the teachings themselves that we need to take hold of. And these teachings have been misguided and misunderstood and gripped by people from the very beginning. And some teachings get generated out of that kind of misunderstanding. And in some cases here where I think he's probably quoting, Huihai himself is quoting some of these teachings, but then using them in some particular way. Though, of course, you actually can take pretty much anything at all and speak of it in a way where it actually points to reality. But that has to do with the nature of reality, which is virtually thus. I mean, wherever you point, you can point at it. But that has to be done through understanding and by someone who actually knows what they're doing. But otherwise, we're going to get caught in ideas and we think we're actually conveying something particular. And the receiver is thinking that they're trying to receive this thing, but I want to understand it in just the right way. We don't understand that it is just as Suzuki Roshi was, you know, kind of implying there, is that just when the talk is occurring, just listen. When the talk is over, your listening is over. That's it. We think there's something else I need to do, and so we'll engage in the very complicated and laborious and tiring kind of, I don't know, studies and acquisition of ideas and thoughts and whatever, because we think this is required. That's a very standard approach into most everyday things in this world of coming and going. That's very helpful. But when it comes to this matter of waking up, not helpful at all. In fact, it leaves you caught. In fact, what he says here, he says, otherwise, he says, you know, if we do this, he says, how does he put it here? He says, we are undertaking the impossible. So if you rely on these things, even Buddhist scriptures, then what you have undertaken here is the impossible. And then he goes on here a little bit. This is interesting, where ourselves deceived, deceiving others. Our mutual downfall is assured. So if we ourselves are also deceived because we're hanging on to something and we want to impart something that's caught here in a scripture that we can, and we've learned it, we've memorized it, and we don't use it as a pointing, in some kind of pointing way. We could use it, we could repeat these words or something, because we actually understand what's being pointed, and it's not in the words. If we actually understand it, yeah, we might use such a passage. Possibly. I mean, I do. Katagiri did. You know, I'll use things that he'll say, or that somebody else out on the street has said. Anything can be used, but it has to be used when we understand what we're saying, what's being pointed out. But there's nothing magical in these teachings, and even in the Buddhist scriptures, that if we just grab hold of it and memorize it or something, that guarantees the true understanding that is there in the passage. So he said, if we rely on this stuff to attain enlightenment, we're undertaking the impossible, ourselves deceived, deceiving others, our mutual downfall is assured. We just keep ourselves and others embroiled in confusion. I was also going to say it is not easy to get ourselves disentangled from all of this, which isn't really quite true. It would seem that way because very few people seem to do this. But it doesn't mean because it's so difficult. Suzuki Roshi again says right at the beginning of his book, he says, we might think it's difficult to become enlightened or to sit zazen or something like this. And he said, but that's not what's difficult about our way. What is difficult, he says, is to purify your mind. Hui Hai talks about this purification of mind, too, we might get to, if I get on with it. I don't, there's too much here. We'll get to what we get to today. But Suzuki wrote, but yeah, to purify the mind. And Hui Hai has quite a bit to say about that. But it's really about not to grip ideas, even good ones, even the teachings of the Buddha. We don't grip this. You know, Buddha himself said that. He used the image of the raft. I think most of you know that. Well, that's done with the raft being the teachings. You don't lug it around with you forever. You know, it serves a function. When that function is used up, you can leave it. But you can leave it for others. Yeah, you might come back to and point out some things by use of the raft or the whatever. But that's it. There's nothing special about it that we need to keep hanging on to and relying on. There's nothing to rely on. You don't need it. It isn't like nothing to rely on. Oh dear, what do I do now? No, you absolutely do not need anything to rely on. It is a matter of just seeing that, waking up to that. But otherwise, you know, we ourselves deceived, we deceive others, and our mutual downfall is assured. Then he says, strive on, explore the teaching most thoroughly. Explore this teaching, what he just pointed out here, most thoroughly. Just let things happen without making any response and keep your minds from dwelling on anything whatsoever. Just like with Yako-san, just sitting there doing nothing. So you're sitting idly, his teacher. And if I was sitting idly, I'd be doing something. Can you imagine this was doing nothing? But here he is. He's got a physical body. Isn't he breathing? Huh? Isn't it? He's doing something. We'll start grasping things like this. Rather than just seeing what's being pointed out here. A physical body? Who? What? And the physical body itself. We can look at that pretty thoroughly. Steve alluded to my book that I finished a while ago, but it'll be coming out next year. Where I get into this, I'll show you that if you're going to rely on the physicality of things, good luck. You will not find anything there at all. And I'll take you by the hand and show you that. But anyway, there's nothing to rely on, but you don't need it. It's just thus. And this isn't anything in particular, but look at it, how vibrant it is. Just this. What is it exactly? You want to say something here, put it in scripture, whatever else, you were tightening things down, and that's delusion right there. And we're caught every time. Instead of just waking up to just this. And of course, with this way, if there's true awakening to this, it isn't me that's awoken to this. But this awakening is all that's ever being experienced. It's just that we get caught by various things. We grip things. So just let things happen. You have to take care of things, sure. Okay, and why? Well, in taking care of things, taking care of your life to some degree, you can keep your life settled. And the objective here is settling the mind. Well, with this settling of your life's affairs and all of these things, but you have to go on, you have to eat, you have to, you know, find shelter, all the stuff that as human beings with bodies that we have to do and all of this. You have to get along with other people. You have to interact with other people. So don't do things that keep riling up the waters around you. And just realize that any little form thing, if you take it as a particular form thing there, it's going to rile the waters. It'll be your mind, because mind itself, while everything is just us coming and going, it isn't riled, so to speak. But your mind can be. And you can easily rile up the minds of others as well, which isn't helpful. Again, for your mind, whatever that is. But you'll remain locked in it, your mind, as long as you do that. Okay. So just let things happen without making any response, and keep your minds from dwelling on anything whatsoever. For they who can do this, thereby enter nirvana. This is nirvana. This is the quieting, the cessation of the extinction of any particularness at all. Okay, well, anyway, and then he goes on. I won't go on with what he says here, but it's really quite interesting. But I thought that was a point I wanted to make today, and so I just kind of jumped to it. He wins his way toward this through a lot of questions and answers in the book. But along the way, he says plenty of pretty remarkable things. So I think I'll just start off here, maybe at the beginning. He has a little verse here of his dedicatory verse. Kind of, it reminds me a little bit of Nagarjuna's, a little bit. But then here, a student asks him, "What method must we practice in order to attain deliverance or awakening?" "It can be attained only through a sudden illumination," he says. Question, what is sudden illumination? Sudden means ridding yourselves of deluded thoughts. Yeah, and here there's a footnote here. He says, deluded thoughts are thoughts involving the dualism of opposites, such as love and hatred, distinctions between self and other, and all other countless thinking processes which proceed from unillumined minds. Okay. So what is sudden illumination? Sudden illumination means ridding yourselves of deluded thoughts instantaneously. Illumination means the realization that illumination is not something to be attained. So illumination is the realization that illumination is not something to be attained. From where do we start this practice? He says you must start from the very root. And what is that? Mind is the root. How can this be known? And then he pulls out several lines from various sutras here, not all of which I think are particularly helpful. But here's what he says when the sutra says. And often he's just saying the sutra says. There is a sutra that says. And he does that partially here, and also he names a few. But I won't be naming any of these. But how can this be known? He says, so the sutra says, when mental processes arise, then do all dharmas, all phenomena springs forth. And when all mental processes cease, then do all dharmas cease likewise. And in another place, there's a sutra that says, actually, I think this is the Vimalakirti. But he says, those desiring to attain the pure land must first purify their own minds. Just purify the mind, which we'll get into more later. But it is this thing of just not holding to views, basically. They must first purify their own minds, for purification of mind is the purity of the Buddha land. Okay, another sutra says, sages seek from mind, not from Buddha. Fools seek from the Buddha instead of seeking from mind. Wise men regulate their minds rather than their persons. Fools regulate their persons rather than their minds. And he goes on like this. If you desire deliverance, then he says, you must first know all about the root. And unless you can penetrate to this truth, all your efforts will be vain. For while you still seek something from forms external to yourselves, you will never attain. And he quotes another sutra here that says, for as long as you direct your search to the forms around you, you will not attain your goal even after eon upon eon. Whereas by contemplating your inner awareness, you can achieve Buddhahood in a single flash of thought, it says here. But this is basically what I'm pointing out to you, when I just invite you to just watch your mind. Just pay attention to just this here. Take care of the things you need to, but again, to keep the life you're living and around you, your surroundings, everything settled so that you can do this. And that's the reason for doing those kinds of things. You know, and so it isn't to tune out what's going on around you. Pay attention to this. You can help to keep this stuff settled, but keep settling the mind. Keep the mind settled, because it is with the settled mind that there is this sudden illumination where we actually see things without delusion. Okay, by what means is the root practice to be performed? And Huihai says, only by sitting in meditation. For it is accomplished by jhana or chan or zen and samadhi. And then another sutra he quotes, jhana and samadhi are essential to the search for the sacred knowledge of the Buddhas. For without these, the thoughts remain in tumult and the roots of goodness suffer damage. Okay, and then he kind of goes on with that a little bit. But then we get to another little section here. What a questioner says, whereon should the mind settle and dwell? Okay, so this is a matter of quieting the mind, settling the mind, pacifying the mind. Whereon should the mind settle and dwell? And no. He says, it should settle upon non-dwelling and there dwell. Okay? He's pointing right at what we need to just realize that. Of course, you might be saying, where do we dwell? You should settle upon non-dwelling and there dwell. Dwell in non-dwelling. It seems like a contradiction. And of course, if we have a logical mind, or just an average mind, a standard mind, a sane mind, perhaps, this would seem kind of crazy. Dwell and not, what kind of a teaching is this? So anyway, here the questioner then says, and what is the meaning of that? And Huihai says, the mind is not fixed on good or evil, being or non-being, inside or outside, or somewhere between the two, void or non-void, empty or non-empty, concentration or distraction. This dwelling upon nothing, and I would say nothing particular, is the state in which it's, because it isn't that we dwell on nothing. This isn't nothing. Clearly, this isn't nothing. So sometimes these teachings, are taken by the translators and that, but they're not quite including enough of the words here. Because I don't, based on other things that Huihai says, I don't think he's talking about nothingness here. But people misunderstand Nagarjuna in the same way. They think that his emptiness, he's talking about nothingness. But that's not it. As Nagarjuna points out, and others as well, including the Buddha, this is to go to an extreme. And if you want to settle the mind, pacify the mind, quiet the mind, don't go to the extremes. You won't find it there. At the extremes, you will tightly be gripping one thing or another. And it'll look like good or bad or right or wrong and, all of that. And we're lost. We're totally lost at that point. And there'll be nothing you can do, as long as you continue to grip like that, to ever straighten it out. You're never going to come around to the right idea or whatever. It just doesn't work that way. It's a matter of seeing and waking up. So he says, this dwelling upon nothing, and I had the word particular, because it isn't just dwelling upon nothing, but it's nothing particular. There's all this apparent particulars floating by, coming by. They're generated, and they disappear, and they come, and they go. And of course, I seem to be one of these things too, and there's bodily components that would seem to be part of this, but there's also the mind and the intellectual and the emotional life and all of this that's going on with all kinds of things swirling about and all of this. But don't dwell on any. So he's not denying that there's nothing like this happening. Well, that clearly isn't it. This isn't nothingness. But it's about not dwelling on anything in particular, as if it were something particular. The particularness is the delusion. And these particulars could be vast things in combination of various things, or they could be microscopic. And you could take that to extend not just to the physical world, but even to ideas and thoughts and emotions. They could be vast and complex, or they could be very seemingly, small. But if we look carefully, they don't have any size. But even the things of the world don't really either, which I'll show you in the book that I've just done. But these things certainly look that way. And some will seem to have a great impact on us, emotionally or in any sort of way. And other things may be slight, or just a kind of a diffuse general feeling, sadness or whatever, just kind of settles over, not just our mind, but even over the whole world. Sometimes, things come and go in this way. But don't dwell on any of it, because with this we will think that these things are genuine, real things. That's not their nature. Their nature is emptiness. But we will not see that if we continue to think that they are particular things. So don't settle on any of it, because you grip one of them, and pretty soon you're building on it. And after a while, you've got structures there that you can hardly take apart. And of course, it isn't really a matter of taking anything apart in the end. That's not how we'll resolve it. It is simply a matter of suddenly, there's our sudden, there's instantaneous way of suddenly seeing, their true nature. Okay. So where am I here? Okay. So this dwelling upon nothing in particular, this is the state in which it should dwell. Okay. And so that's why dwelling is non-dwelling. You see? Can you see that? Of course, if we try to put this into words, you're not going to erase the contradiction that seems to be there. But that's in the words. But you can see that this dwelling is non-dwelling. Even as we dwell in our confusion on thoughts of myself and, anything at all, the sishin or the bird outside, anything at all we could dwell on. But even as we're dwelling, this dwelling is a mistake. It's a mistake because there is no dwelling anywhere. But we think that there is. We think that there's persistence and that things endure and they persist. But this is part of our confusion and our delusion. All the pain and sorrow and the confusion and the uncertainty that you experience is caught in that view of things, which you will not relinquish easily, as Dogen points out, and this is why we don't wake up. Of course, there's a lot of joyful things there, too, that you don't want to relinquish either. But that's okay. You'll still feel the sorrow and the joy, even when we relinquish it. And I talked about this just recently, I guess. I think my last Sunday talk here, I don't know. Anyway, but this dwelling, I don't know if this is a microphone, I don't know how it'll work. It's fighting with my book here, so I can't. But I'm sorry, my eyes are not so good. I actually read more, I can see more clearly without my glasses, but then I have to hold the book kind of close. So anyway, bear with me here. But this dwelling upon nothing particular, is the state in which it should dwell. Those who attain it, and attain is a, we've talked about that particular troublesome word. Because, it is just like this dwelling isn't really dwelling, and attaining isn't really attaining either. But still we speak, because we are talking about the world where there seems to be this and that, and those who attain, and there's those, I suppose, who would, haven't attained, at least, but then we say, not yet, anyway. So we'll talk like this. But again, everything that we're saying, this is why Suzuki Roshi says, you can really kind of forget this in the end, but we're just pointing here now. And the value of this kind of teaching and hearing this is not in trying to get particulars out of it. That's how we normally approach learning. And you know. But it is in just as we're going through this, just, things are being pointed out here. And just see, just take it in. You know, pay attention while it's being pointed out or when you read. But you don't need to grip it. Something else is going on here that will allow you, if you come around to this kind of teaching and take up this practice, at some point, the Dharma eye just opens of itself. You will see this. And then that's what needs to be done. It won't be through some intellectual grasp of anything here. So where are we here? So this dwelling, so those who attain this, attain to it, are said to have non-dwelling minds. In other words, they have Buddha minds. Minds of Buddha, which of course actually you already have, because you already have this non-dwelling mind. You just, it isn't, of course it isn't you that has it. Because you, that's something particular again now, it's being grasped. But here it is. This is what is experienced all the time. This is why we also point out at times that you are Buddha. You know, this awakening is already yours. You already know this. And with a direct, sudden realization of this, all of this will be very familiar. You know, everything here that might now sound vague and mysterious is very familiar to you. And at some point, too, you might hear, maybe you've even noticed it now, every once in a while, there's something there. You can hear it singing along with this, because there's understanding there. That's where that's coming from, because you do know. You do know truth. You do know reality. It's just a matter that our confusion and our delusion is that we lock ourselves away, we form ourselves and lock ourselves away from just this. Fortunately, though, you can't get away, really. But we'll kind of see it that way. So anyway, but he goes on asking here, so what does mind resemble? Of course, mind is just this. It doesn't resemble anything. But he says, mind has no color, such as green or yellow, red or white. It is not, and this also echoes Wang Po here, red or white, it is not long or short, it does not vanish or appear, it is free from purity and impurity alike, and its duration is eternal. It's just simply thus. Mind is it. No coming or going of mind. It is utter stillness. Yeah, in totality, it is utter stillness. The movement and change and everything is in the particulars, which are illusory appearances. It is utter stillness. Such then is the form and shape of our original mind, which is also our original body. And this is the Buddhakaya, or the body of reality here. He has a footnote for this one. The Buddhakaya, we talk about the Dharmakaya in our morning chant. But the Buddha body, the Buddhakaya, kaya just means body. The Buddha body is another term for the Dharmakaya, or Dharma body, the undifferentiated body in which the Buddhas and all other beings are conceived as one with the Absolute. Well, I don't know. Never mind the word conceived. They're just seen as one with the Absolute. All of us possess this body without illumination, but we're not aware of it. But this is all there is. It's just this Buddha body or Dharmakaya. By what means do this body or mind perceive? Can they perceive with eyes, ears, nose, sense of touch, and consciousness? No, there are not several means of perception like that. Then what sort of perception is involved, since it is unlike any of those already mentioned? It is pure perception. Being essentially pure, no, it is pure perception, and that's why, too, purify your mind. Just Another way of trying to just reduce it down to the pure perceptual and realize that. Without the conceptual, the constant, the condensing out of various things, you know, the term I want for that, but that are appearing within this field of perception. That's the conceptual, and we get caught by that. The particulars are forming always, and if we don't see them, know them directly as empty, we go with those, ignoring the supersaturated solution. Never mind. I was going to try to get an image from chemistry, but I can't remember the terms I need. I'm getting old anyway, but... By what means does his body or mind perceive? Okay, then what sort of perception is involved? Since it's unlike he said, it's pure perception. Being essentially pure and utterly still, it's immaterial and motionless. Okay, so that's why, you know, he's pointing it's immaterial. It's not of the particulars itself. The particulars appear here, and that's where there seems to be motion and all the rest of this stuff, but. This reality itself is total, it's complete, it's motionless. So that's what he's pointing out. So essentially what he's saying is it doesn't form as an object to the mind. So then the question goes on, since it cannot be found, where does such perception come from? Of course, this is what we'll think when we're thinking in terms of particularness, or we're seeing things in terms of non-emptiness, as Nagarjuna might say, which is our normal view. We see things in terms of substance, and those are the various things that we keep wanting to grab hold of and try to manipulate in some way so that we can make sense of things. So when we see things in terms like that, which is our ordinary view of things, we'll ask a question like this. Since it cannot be found as some particular there now, this is just thus, where does such perception come from? As if it comes from someplace. It is totality. It's not coming from anywhere. It is just simply thus. This is the eternal that he just spoke of. It's never been otherwise. It could not be otherwise. And that also can be seen. This reality cannot be other than what it is. And that's something that when we see its nature, you realize that this is the case. It cannot be nothing, and it isn't nothing. Again, that book I worked on there, I'll take on that question, the big question in philosophy since Leibniz posed it about 3 centuries ago. Why is there something rather than nothing? Well, this is I call it a flat earth question. That isn't what we see here. We don't see something rather than nothing. You certainly don't see nothing, but our problem is that we think that we see something. We see particularness, and we think it's real. Were we to see its true nature, we'd be released from all of this. And we wouldn't ask a question like, well, then where does it come from? It's the stuff that is appearing here, appearing to come and to go. You know, as Buddha pointed out in his name, the way he referred to himself, Tathagata. Coming and going thus, coming and going as it appears here. He says that instead of I, because I would imply that there's something persisting here, me. You can give it a name, and it lasts for as long as you live. We can keep that name. Or you can change it, but yeah. But it's kind of attached, persisting. But coming and going thus, coming and going as everything appears to be coming and going here. But there isn't any particulars. There isn't anything in particular that's coming or going. And with no coming or going, there isn't anything, in terms of words of, like, come. Where does it come from? This doesn't, and where is it, what's it going to? This doesn't apply. Of course, that doesn't seem to make sense. But that's if we're still kind of holding to something, trying to get a grip on that, Dogen says you don't relinquish your views. You don't need to get another grip on another view here, but allow this to direct your attention to what's, because that's how this teaching is meant. It's not meant for you to grasp it at all, but it's pointing to something that you can notice directly yourself, and that's an example of it right here. You can. I'm sure you're well acquainted with the appearances of coming and going, birth and death, and all this kind of stuff. We've seen multiple examples of it in all kinds of ways. Not just physical things, but thoughts and ideas and emotions and just coming and going. So it might seem that everything is, everything formed is like this, but there's something else here that doesn't exhibit this coming and going. And you know this. This is. Why doesn't you then know? You're something that comes and goes. But this is readily seen. It is right here. So these teachings are about to get us to slow down, to quiet down, to settle the mind so you can notice this. And if you do notice, if you truly notice it, not as some formed model of this, I've given you words and maybe you can form a model with it. That's not going to just actual. In spite of yourself, you see this. That's it. And that's this sudden illumination that he's speaking of here. So anyway, so this fellow here is asking, so if it can't be found, then where does this such perception come from? And Huihai says, we may liken it to a bright mirror, which though it contains no forms, can nevertheless perceive all forms. And Blofeld puts that word perceive in quotes here, which is probably a good idea. Why? Just because it is free from mental activity. If you students of the way had minds unstained, they would not give rise to falsehood and their attachment to the subjective ego and to the objective externals would vanish. Then purity would arise of itself, and you would thereby be capable of such perception. Okay, so here, when he says, no, when I take my glasses off, I can't see the glass. Okay, ooh. Okay, wow. This is the point where I was just going to get started. Oh, well. Next session. Once you come to the next session, I might carry this. Anyway, so he says, so we may liken this to a bright mirror, which, though it contains no forms, it can nevertheless, he says perceiver, but project this. It seems to be, and there's a problem with that, which I'll talk to eventually. But why? Just because it is free from mental activity. If you students of the way had minds unstained, they would not give rise to falsehood and their attachment to the subjective ego and to the objective externals would vanish. Then purity would arise of itself and you would thereby be capable of such perception. So he says, if you students of the way had minds unstained, and there's a footnote here with this unstained, and he says that... Wu Jian is the Chinese that he's working with here. Maybe translated as pure, undefiled, unstained, etc. I prefer the more literal and picturesque term unstained. Okay. But then going on here a little bit, he says, a mirror can reflect every kind of form, yet remain spotless. And that's kind of the image of the mirror. It's often used in Zen teaching, the image of a mirror. In your chant books, we have the song of the jewel mirror awareness. But a mirror can reflect every kind of form, yet remain spotless. The mirror itself doesn't have anything on it. You know, there's no image in it. It can reflect any image at all. For it is entirely indifferent to what it reflects. Our minds, when purified, will become similarly impervious to stain. See, the thing was with our minds, unlike a mirror that'll just reflect what's showing up there, our minds will leave stains on the mirror. The images and things will start to stain the mirror, staining the mind. So the mind, this is why I tell you to watch your mind and to realize, this is when Dogen is talking about, you know, loosen your grip here, relinquish your views. These are stains. These are distorting the view, coloring the view and making it difficult to see what's really being reflected there or presented there. Our minds, when purified, will become similarly impervious to stain. It must be added that from a Buddhist point of view, a stain is a stain whether it results from something good or something we call evil. Something we call good or something we call evil. And I've talked about that on plenty of other occasions, that it isn't a matter of labeling things as good or evil. You can't determine what is good. You have the story, it's a Taoist story of the wise Chinese farmer. You know, who can say what's good or bad? Yeah, in some limited sphere, in the relative world, it seems like certain things might be good in some limited way, but be very careful with that. And rather than using the word good, it might be helpful to just think that, to say that, yeah, well, helpful might be a good word, just to notice that under these circumstances, this would be helpful. But ultimately, helpful for what, though? And of course, if we're still seeing things in relative terms, now we're, sooner or later you get to the end of the road there and you go, well, I don't know. Does it really matter, man? That's usually where we'll end up. But I'll tell you, this is, we keep it simple. If you talk about wholesome and unwholesome rather than good and bad and all that, right from the very start, you can realize that we can do things that bring us into the whole. Norm, I think, is going to be talking about this tomorrow when the Buddha points out, I think I've got this right, 183rd, yeah. And where the Buddha says, to do what is wholesome, to avoid what is unwholesome. Purify your own mind, he says. Do what is and then he says, this is the teaching of the way. Here it is in a nutshell. This is the whole thing. This is so important. I know you've heard me say this over and over again, this verse and that. And Norm's going to, I'm sure, have some plenty to say about it again tomorrow now. But listen very carefully, because this gets really to the heart of where our trouble is. So do what is wholesome. Don't do the thing about good. Good is always debatable. Don't think in terms of good or bad. It's not helpful. But what is of the whole? And here's a characteristic of the whole. Is that it is settled. It is quiet. So we can do those things that don't disturb, you know, the water or the grounds or the mud or whatever is around us here. And don't disturb your mind. Keep it agitated and that sort of thing. We have the precepts, you know, like not to lie, you know, not to say what is false. Why? Well, because it's bad, it's evil, you know, it's no good if you lie, it's a sin. But why? What's the problem with it ultimately? Maybe I can get what I want if I just tell a lie here. Yeah, that'll only go for so long. No, I'll tell you what's wrong with that if you look at it in terms of wholesome and unwholesome is that you tell a lie, now you're rattled with trying to keep that story consistent unless you're like somebody we all know and doesn't seem to worry at all about being consistent. But normally, you're going to want to try to keep your story straight. And that's a lot of work. It's very difficult. And all the while, your mind will be agitated. And this is what you don't want to do. That's why. So don't live out of lies and deceit. It isn't helpful. It will not quiet and settle your mind. You're doing something that's going to stir it up. So this is why, to do what is of the whole, and not what is of the unwhole or the broken up, the divided, the stuff that's in contention with other and all that sort of thing. That's why. And it's just simply that. It's not because God or somebody out there said, well, this is good, you do that. Why? Well, never mind that kind of thinking. That's dualistic again. But I just pointed to why. And all the precepts will operate in this very same way. It'll direct you to ways in which you can live and speak and interact with others in ways that'll help your mind to settle down. Learn these things. And reflect on it. Watch your mind. Notice how, when you do these various things, notice how the mind gets set to rocking back and forth and tumbling and disturbing. And holding to views is one of the best ways to keep all this thing tipping and turning in various ways. So that's what's behind these teachings here. So he says, if you students of the way had minds unstained, now unstained just simply means it isn't caught by the various things that are staining the mind, thinking that rather than seeing the various particulars as empty of any kind of substance, we treat them and believe that they are substantial and that they are particular things and that they have weight and substance and all this kind of stuff. And this is with the stained mind. And he talks about this staining elsewhere as well. So he said, if you students of the way had minds unstained, they would not give rise to falsehoods, and their attachment to the subjective ego and to the objective externals would vanish. Then purity would arise of itself. The purity is already there. We just don't keep covering it with stuff. And you would thereby be capable of such perception, he says. Okay, and then, I've already gone over an hour, so I guess I'm not going to go. I was going to turn to, here I'm on page 48, but I was going to turn to page 91, where he picks up, and this is getting close to the part I read right before. There's a lot in between, too, that I, someday maybe I might comment on some of these things. There's some interesting stuff there. But no, not on 91. I wanted to go to, here we are, page 89. Here the questioner says, you spoke of refraining from thinking. The thinking gets into think not thinking. Dogen, that didn't originate with Dogen either, think not thinking. But and then he's commenting on it here in the book. But he says, you spoke of refraining from not thinking, but you did not finish your explanation. So here he asks if you could go on with that here. And that's where I was going to go next. But we have gone over an hour already, and that's kind of a natural breaking point. So I think I'll just stop at this point. But do you have any questions about anything we looked at here today? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.